The Shoreshin Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Hello, everybody. This is Bill, and this is our Torah portion commentary called Shelach Lecha, or our commentary on the Torah portion called Shelach Lecha, which means send for yourself. And this is taken from Bamidbar, or Numbers, chapter 13, verse 1, going through chapter 15, verse 41. In this portion, Israel is at the threshold of crossing into the land of Israel. And some scholars contend that the victory over the king of Arad that is recorded for us in Numbers chapter 21 had already taken place. And this victory took place at Horma, or complete destruction is what it really means. And because of this great victory, that's why Moses felt that the time may have been right to begin the conquest of the land. In fact, in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 22, we see that Israel came to Moses requesting that he send spies. And that is, again, according to the scholarly view, because of this great victory over Arad at Horma. And so, in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 22, it says, "Then all of you came near to me and said, 'Let us send men before us, that we may explore the land for us, and bring us word again of the way by which we must go up, and the cities into which we shall come.' The thing seemed good to me, and I took 12 men from you, one man from each tribe." And so what we see here is that the reason that the people want or request spies to go into the land is not to see if we can take it, but how we're going to take it. What's the route we're going to take? What cities are we going to encounter, etc.? And so that seemed good to Moses. And so that's why he consented to what the people had requested. Now, of course, what we're going to find is that the result of this tour is a demoralizing report, and that causes the people to lose faith in the ability to possess the land. In fact, that became a turning point for all these people who had come out of Egypt. Those who had been born in slavery are now going to be destined to die in the wilderness because the result of their request is not how we're going to take the land, but that we can't take the land, or that's what they conclude. And so because of this report, the conquest of the land was delayed for about 39 years. And as a result, that those who were born in the wilderness, those not born in Egypt, they would be the ones to possess the land. So again, apparently, if scholarly views are to be trusted, this victory that's recorded in Numbers 21 led to the people requesting the spies, again, not to see if we can take the land, but how we're going to take the land. Moses thinks this is a good idea. He selects these 12 men, but of course we get this evil report, and as a consequence, the people are barred from going into the land for another 39 years. Those who came out of Egypt 20 years and older are all going to die, and it's going to be their children who go in to possess the land. So with considering all that this happened, or what the outcome of all this is, why was it necessary to send the spies? If God had already said you're going to possess the land, why wouldn't that have been enough? And why wouldn't it have been enough just to say, when God says we go into the land, we go into the land? In my opinion, Moses' objective for the tour was much different than that of the 10 spies. In other words, he sent them to see how. They went to see if. But nonetheless, this was brought about because of the people's wishes, and we see that Moses succumbs to the wishes of the people because it seemed good. Now, what I get from this is that there are times in Scripture, and it's very obvious, that God permits the people to do what they want to do. He permits them to go with their wishes. But oftentimes, we see, well, maybe even all the time, we see that when he consents to the people's will, when he gives them what they want, it's to teach them that that was not what they needed. They wanted to be like everybody else. They wanted a king. And so he gave them Saul of Kish. And that didn't turn out so well for them. So again, as we kind of move into the Torah portion, it seems that God, through Moses, is allowing the people to go spy out the land, and yet he does this knowing what's going to happen. Is it because he's allowing them what they want to teach them? That's not what they needed. And so it says in chapter 13 that God says to Moses, Shelach lecha, or you send for yourself. And if he is sending for yourself, that would say, or it would seem to say, if you want to send them, it's up to you. I'll let you make the decision. I'll let you make the choice. And he leaves this decision to Moses, again, knowing what was going to happen. And so, like I said, that's why I believe this may be one of those cases where he consents to the people's wishes, but it's to teach the people that what they wish for is not what they really needed. Now, the word that is translated spy out or search is the Hebrew word tur, which is kind of interesting, maybe even ironic. Tur. Tav vav resh. Tur. Because that's exactly what they're doing. They're touring the land. They're searching it out. They're spying it out. And so they were sent to tour the land to see how to take it, not if they could take it. Maybe Moses also sends them with the objective of seeing if this time to take it is appropriate, if now is the time, or maybe it should be later. You know, that's a possibility. But at any rate, Moses selects the princes of different tribes, or of the different tribes. He selects leaders, and these are apparently people that he trusted, or people who had gained respect among their tribes. For instance, he selects Caleb from Judah, and Hosea, or Joshua, from Ephraim. And the Torah portion gives us all the other princes of the tribes, but there's one other I wanted to mention, just kind of as a footnote, it's kind of interesting. And that is Setur, who is of the tribe of Asher. And Setur, which is spelled Samech Tav Valresh, comes from the verb satar, which means to hide or conceal, and thus his word or his name means concealed or hidden. And that's interesting for two reasons. Number one, if you look at the word or name Setur, it's Samech Tav Vav Resh, and it contains the word Tav Vav Resh, Tur, which is translated spy out. So interestingly enough, one of the spies, one of the ones that are sent to tour the land, is in fact called Setur, which literally means hidden. But it's also interesting to point out that Setur is the only name in all of the Hebrew text that if you take the numerical equivalents for the different letters, it totals to 666. Now, what does that mean? What should we deduce from that? I frankly don't know. Maybe nothing. But it's just kind of an interesting footnote. One of those things that you come across in the text that makes you go, Now, in verse 16, it says that Moses called Hosea, the son of Nun, not Nun, but Hosea, the son of Nun, he called him Joshua, or Yehoshua, which literally means he will save. Yehoshua comes from the root word Yasha, to save. Yehoshua, he will save in the future, as opposed to Yeshua, who saves in present tense. He saves right now. In other words, Yehoshua becomes a picture in one sense of Yeshua, in that Yehoshua leads them into the land. Yeshua leads us into our promise. He leads us into the possession of the promise that the Father has given to us. In fact, Yehoshua is the son of Nun, and Nun is a word that is associated with fish because it means perpetual, something that resprouts, and fish are perpetuating. They multiply very rapidly. And so Yehoshua is the son of Nun, something that is perpetual. And so again, Yehoshua is one of those that stands out because of what his name implies and the role that he plays. Now in verse 17, it says that Moses sent them to the south first and then on into the north country. In fact, it literally says he sent them to the Negev, which is some desert regions south of Beersheba. and they went as far north as Mount Hermon. So they traversed the land from north to the south, which the land, as I understand it, is approximately 180 miles from north to the south. It's about 40 miles east to west. And they traversed the land for 40 days from north to south to east to west. Here's something interesting. It occurred to me, that, and it had not before, that there were Israelites who did in fact go into the land of Canaan very soon after the Exodus. And in a sense, the 12 tribes went into the land of Israel very soon after the Exodus. Of course, representatives of those tribes, but nonetheless, just something to consider. Now, verse 20 says that Moses encourages them to be of good courage and to bring fruits of the land. And this occurred at the time of the first ripe grapes, it says, which would probably be somewhere in late July, early August, somewhere in there. Now, verse 22 is a very interesting verse because even though some translations do not render it this way, when you look at it in Hebrew, this is what it says. They ascended, they went into the land, he arrived at Hebron. So they went into the land, but only he came to Hebron. And what that is to insinuate is that there is only one person who went to Hebron. And that's interesting because in Hebron is where the sons of the Anakim were, or that is the giants, these very tall men. These are the men, of course, that are going to influence the 10 spies to give an evil report. Well, they were in the area of Hebron. And so apparently, as the 12 are going into the land, only one of them goes to Hebron. And that one, according to rabbinical sources anyway, is Caleb. Because Caleb wanted to go to the cave at Machpelah, which is where Abraham and where Isaac and where Jacob are buried. And so he goes to that place. And then, of course, later on, he is going to be given this land. Now, again, this is the land where the children of Anak are, or literally, that name means neck. And so that is to infer that they had long necks or they were tall and slender people, giants. And so their appearance gave rise to the tradition that they were descended from the Nephilim or the giants. Now, in verse 23, it says that they, in accordance with Moses' commands, they cut a cluster of grapes at Eshkol. Eshkol literally means cluster. And along with this, they brought back other fruits, but these particular cluster of grapes, they carried it on a double pole because it was so many and it was so big. And so they had to carry it on a double pole. So what is this evidence of? That this is in fact a land of milk and honey. I believe that probably Moses instructs them to do this because it would be evidence to the people that this in fact is a land of milk and honey. When the 12 spies return, in verse 27, they begin to give their report. But it's going to be an evil report. But look at how they begin their evil report. It is indeed a land of milk and honey. And so they are going to slander the land, but they're going to begin with something that is true. In other words, every slander, every lie, always contains a measure of truth. And so that's how they begin their evil report, with something that is indeed true. It gives it plausibility. It gives it integrity, if that's the right word, I'm not sure, but you know what I mean. And so they begin their evil report and notice that they didn't go to Moses privately. They go to Moses and the people. They're speaking to all the people at the same time. Now, of course, it was the people who came to Moses and said, you know, send some people into the land and see how we're going to do this. And so you would expect that then when they come back, they would give a report to the people as well. But the point, I guess, is that you would think that they would go to Moses if they had noble intentions and say, look, we encountered a problem and we need to talk to you about it. But they don't. They go to the people too. And that would hint, I think, that they had evil intentions, perhaps some of them before they went, maybe as they're going, but nonetheless, they didn't go to Moses privately and say, here's what we encountered and here's what we're concerned about, which would be the noble thing to do. But no, they go directly to the people and they begin to lay out this evil report. And so they begin by saying, it's a land of milk and honey, but in verse 28, they say, how be it? Or in other words, it's a great place, but the people are fierce. The cities are big. They're many. They're fortified. And besides that, the children of Anak, or giants, are there. And so the message was, even though this is a great place, there is absolutely no way we can possess it. And if that wasn't enough, in verse 29, guess who else is there? Amalek is there. And that was to say, this is impossible. There's no way we can do it. Now, a question that I have, and I don't have the answer, but how did they know that the children of Anak, or giants, are there? I mean, if Caleb is the one who went up to Hebron, and that's where the children of Anak were, that suggests one of two things. That they saw them from the distance, or they saw them from a distance, and refused to go any further. Or heard Caleb talk about the people who were there, and just decided to deduce from that, that, you know, these giants there, we can't go there. I don't know. I'm just saying that somehow or another they knew that these giants were there. Now, in Deuteronomy, we are given some detail as to the people's interpretation of these statements. In chapter 1, verse 28, the people say, where are we going up? Our brothers have made our hearts melt, saying, the people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and fortified up to heaven. And besides, we have seen the sons of the Anakim there. So that may be the answer to the question I just posed, that they saw the children of Anakim, or the sons of Anakim, but if Caleb's the only one who went to Hebron, that would insinuate that they didn't get any closer. They saw them, but they didn't dare go near them. They became fearful, and so maybe that's when they begin to hatch their evil report. Now, Moses' response to this statement is recorded in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 29 to 32. He says, then I said to you, do not be in dread or afraid of them. The Lord your God who goes before you will himself fight for you, just as he did for you in Egypt before your eyes and in the wilderness, where you have seen how the Lord your God carried you, as a man carries his son, all the way that you went until you came to this place. Yet in spite of this word, you did not believe the Lord your God. And so Moses tries to refute the fears and speak to the fears and calm them, but they won't listen. In verse 30, Caleb, who's been listening to Moses, becomes inspired by what Moses says, and then he tries to silence the people who were apparently yelling at Moses with this declaration. He says, we should go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it. And literally what he says is, we will certainly overcome it. Because Caleb, we understand, has a different spirit. Caleb is the one, according to the interpretation, is the one who comes to Hebron. He's the one who dares go to the Cave of Machpelah, where these children or sons of Anakim are. So Caleb tries to say, look, we can do this. You know, I was there too. I saw the sons of Anakim, and I'm telling you, we can overcome them. But the other 10 spies, of course, refute Caleb's attempt to inspire the people. And so the people end up listening to the majority report. In verse 31, here's what they basically say. Even if God does help us, they're still stronger than we are. And then that would say this. They're stronger than God. And so they put their eyes on the circumstances rather than listening to what God said. And so then in verse 32, they began to spread an evil report about the land itself, which is kind of interesting. And that they spread this evil report about the land would suggest that they did not do it in the presence of Moses. This is apparently something that happens as the people are returning to their tents, really unsure as who to believe, Moses or these 10 spies. And so as the people go back to their tents, uncertain, these 10 spies send an evil word throughout the camp. And here's what they say. It's a land that devours its inhabitants, which is understood to be, it doesn't produce enough fruit. And yet they brought back this cluster of grapes and these other fruits from the land. It included this point that the people are of great stature. And in fact, we saw Nephilim. We saw giants. Of course, these were the sons of Anak, which is also a word rendered as giant, who was of the Nephilim, who was of these giants. Of course, this is recall to mind the giants or the Nephilim of Genesis chapter 6, 4, which, again, my question is, how would they have known that? But nonetheless, they saw these giants. They saw the Nephilim. And so because of the stature of the people, because the land will not support us, and because there are giants there, we just simply can't do this. And so the people began to listen to what the spies had seen. And what they saw infected the rest of the people. It's important, I believe, to point out here that, spiritually speaking, hearing is more important than seeing. They saw the Nephilim, and that prompted them to give an evil report. Caleb, Joshua, heard what the Creator has said, that you'll possess the land. And they chose to go with what God said, or what they had heard, rather than what they had seen in the land, necessarily. The ear, and not the eye, is the center of balance. But when your ear is infected, you can't stand upright, and you can't walk straight. You teeter, you totter, and you falter. But because your hearing is affected, the equilibrium within your ear is affected, and so you can't walk upright. The Shema says, "Hear, O Israel," not "See, O Israel." Yeshua did not say, "He that hath an eye, let him see," but "He that has an ear, let him hear." And so again, the point is, spiritually speaking, it's more important to hear what God is saying than to see what the adversary is doing. Because if you focus on what the adversary is doing, you can't really hear what God is saying. So that is what they're doing. And so they begin to slander the land itself so as to convince the people that we can't go in and do this land. And what's interesting about this, well, beyond the obvious, is that they had just witnessed Miriam's punishment, that is, of leprosy, and that punishment came about because of her slandering Moses. So apparently they haven't learned their lesson. And because they slandered the land, the people become overwhelmed with fear of the inhabitants of the land. And in chapter 14, verse 1, the people begin to heed the slander of the spies, and they begin to weep, and they begin to consider that it would have been better that they were to die in Egypt or even in the wilderness than it would be for us to go into the land. And they come to the conclusion that their wives and their little ones are going to die at the hands of these inhabitants, or they're going to die here, and why did you bring us out here? And therefore, they begin to think that it would be best for them to select a new leader to replace Moses, and someone who will bring them or take them back to Egypt and back into their bondage. In other words, they end up making the same mistake they had made just earlier when they lusted for the food of Egypt. Because they felt that bondage in Egypt was better than what God had intended for them. And so they began to raise their voice in lament and begin to set their minds on returning to Egypt. Traditionally, this day, when all this happened, was the 9th of Av. And the 9th of Av is a very ominous day in Israeli history. And tradition teaches that it's on the 9th of Av that both the first temple and the second temple was destroyed by the Babylonians and the Romans, respectively. And so the 9th of Av is a day that is always associated, in Israeli history anyway, with bad tidings. And so it's traditional that this day, when the people bought into the evil report of the spies, begin to lament and begin to wail and wish to go to Egypt under new leadership, that this day was the 9th of Av, and thus it was determined that Israel would be destined to lament on this day again and again. It's almost like God saying, "Oh, you're going to cry? Well, okay, I'm going to give you something to cry about." In the midst of all of this, it says that Joshua and Caleb rent their clothes. In verse 7, they said to the people, they admonished the people, "Do not rebel against the Lord, In fact, they said that these people, they are bred for us, which is to say, we can easily defeat these people because their defense is removed, or literally, their shadow is removed. Now, one scholar renders this statement this way. He says that the bread that's mentioned, they are bread for us, refers to manna. And the shadow that is removed from them refers to the fact that when the shadow, so to speak, is removed in the morning and the sun comes out, it would cause the manna to melt. And so in other words, the message is, when they are bread for us, their shadow is removed, is to say, look, these people, they're like the manna that melts away when the sun comes out. And so the Lord will cause them to melt away. We can defeat them. Now, a footnote to this is that it's believed, anyway, that Job, righteous Job, had lived in the land of Canaan. But now Job was dead. So in other words, there were no righteous among them anymore. And because Job was dead, the only righteous among them, that their shadow had melted away. They have no defense. They have no reason that we can't go in and overcome them. Now, as Caleb and as Joshua are trying to admonish the people here, had it not been for the glory of the Lord appearing in the Mishkan, the people would have rose up and stoned the two of them. And so once again, what we see is that the nation of Israel is on the brink of annihilation. And because of that, Moses, faithful Moses, steps in once more to intercede on behalf of the people, just as he interceded for them on the mountain. Because God had told Moses, in a manner of speaking, step aside, I'm going to wipe these people out, and I'm going to make you a second Abraham. But Moses doesn't step aside so that he can wipe them out. But Moses begins to speak to God and claim that, if you do that, the nations are going to say that you could not bring them into the land, that you weren't able to bring them into the land. And he goes on and argues that, God, you should forgive them for the sake of your honor, for the sake of your name. And in verse 17, he continues by saying that God's attribute of mercy and that attribute which says of him that he is slow to anger, that those attributes should prevail over his attribute of justice. And what he's doing is he's relating back to what God had spoken to him on Mount Sinai after Moses had interceded for the people in light of the golden calf incident. And in Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7, here's what the Creator says to Moses in the mountain after that event. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and the fourth generations. So in other words, even though he is just, and even though he will not permit the guilty to go unpunished, before he is just, he's merciful, he's gracious, he's slow to anger, he abounds in love and faithfulness. So obviously Moses is motivated to ask forgiveness for the people again because he understands that God is slow to anger. He understands that we can go to God and humbly ask him for forgiveness again, and even for the same thing. But now compare that with our hesitation to go to any fellow man and ask them repeatedly for forgiveness. Well, man is not as apt to do that as God, and Moses knows that. And so he appeals to God once again to forgive them again of their sin. In verse 22, in this conversation, God alludes to the fact that, he refers to the fact that 10 times Israel has tested him. And because of that, these people who had determined that we're not able to possess the land wouldn't possess the land because 10 times they've tested me. And The 10 times are believed to be, the first one being in Exodus 14, verse 11, when the people are at the edge of the Red Sea and say, you know, what did you do to bring us out here in the wilderness to die? And then in Exodus 15, verse 24, at the waters of Marah. Then in Exodus 16, when they ran out of food, in verse 3. And then in Exodus 16, verse 20, when they allowed leftover manna to remain, which they weren't supposed to do. And then in Exodus 16, verse 27, when they gathered manna on Shabbat, which they were not supposed to do. Exodus 17, verse 2, when they had no water at Rephidim. Of course, in Exodus 32, when they worshipped the golden calf. Then in Numbers 11, when they rebelled against God's commands in verse 1. And then in verse 4, they complained about the manna. And now, here in chapter 14, they are believing the spy's report. So these 10 different times that they tested him. And so when these 10 things had happened, he said, that's enough. These people who said, we can't possess this land, aren't going to possess this land. And yet, he distinguishes Caleb from among them, because he says Caleb has another spirit within him. And Caleb is courageous. Caleb is faithful to believe God's promise. In verse 24, he says, he has followed me fully, which is literally to say, he is fulfilled to walk behind me, to follow in my footsteps, so to speak, which provokes this thought. Yeshua says, if you're going to follow me, you have to take up your cross and follow me. Follow behind me. And so, considering what God says of Caleb, we could argue that those who are to follow Yeshua have to be of this other spirit. They have to be of the kind of mindset and heart that says, you know, I believe God, and therefore I'm going to follow behind him in his footsteps, and I believe that we can overcome any obstacle because I am choosing to hear what God says rather than to look at what the adversary is doing. So Caleb, because he is of another spirit and has been faithful and has been courageous because he believed and trusted in God, he received as an inheritance Hebron and the surrounding hill country, that same place he went to where all the sons of Anak were, where the giants were. And in Joshua chapter 14, we read that he inherited that land because he had gone there before, saw the giants, determined we can still overcome them. And therefore, when he goes into the land, he in fact does defeat the giants, the same one that Israel feared. Now, later on, this fear of giants is going to pop up again. In fact, we can read about it when the armies of Israel are contesting the armies of the Philistines, and Goliath of Gath is out there taunting the armies of Israel, and there's none among the armies of Israel who are willing to go and face the giant, except this little shepherd boy by the name of David, who has a heart after God, or let's put it this way, who's of another spirit. And his confidence is not necessarily in his sling, but his confidence is in the fact that God, the God of Israel, is going to be with him as he goes up against this uncircumcised Philistine. So Israel has always been affected by this fear and intimidation of the giants in the land, but God has always had a remnant among them who choose not to look at the circumstance, but to hear what God says through the circumstance. Now, in verse 25, after all of this has happened, then they are told to turn away from the land that is inhabited by the Amalekites. In other words, because you believed you couldn't defeat the Amalekites, now I'm not going to be with you if you go that way, and therefore you won't be able to defeat the Amalekites. In other words, in the natural sense of things, these things that you do see, if it weren't for the fact that I was with you, you wouldn't be able to overcome the giants. You wouldn't be able to overcome the Amorites and the Amalekites. But because I am with you, you can overcome any obstacle. But you chose to believe what your eyes saw rather than what your ears heard. And so as a consequence, I'm not going to go that way with you now. And therefore, you better not go that way. Now, in verse 27, he says, how long shall I bear with this people? Literally, how long shall this evil congregation continue to be? The fact that he calls them an evil congregation reminds me of a statement that Yeshua makes in the Gospel of Matthew when he talks about a wicked and adulterous generation. And the context of that is Messiah had performed sign after sign after sign after sign. But the generation that saw these signs wouldn't believe the signs because the signs were to point them to the conclusion that Yeshua was the Messiah. But they refused to believe the signs. And so they come to him and say, "We desire of you another sign." And he says, "A wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign." A generation that has been lured away from the truth by their eyes, adulterous, and their hearts, wicked, always want a sign, and yet you don't believe the signs that I've already given you. So, likewise, Israel has not regarded the signs that God had performed for them, the plagues, the Passover, bringing them through the Red Sea, the manna, the water at the rock, Mount Sinai and that experience, and all these different things, all these signs that he had given them that should have convinced them that whatever he says they can do simply because that's his will. But they wouldn't believe it. And so he says, how long is this evil generation going to continue? How long is this evil congregation going to continue? Or as Yeshua says, a wicked and adulterous generation. So because they didn't regard what God had already done, they fell into unbelief. And so God determined to do to them or allow to happen to them the very thing that they had said. And that is that we would die in this wilderness, that we would have died here in the wilderness rather than have to go face these giants. And so God determines that all those who had murmured against him, who were 20 years old and up, would in fact die in the wilderness, just like they said. However, in verse 31, he says, but your little ones, the ones you were so concerned about that would die, well, guess what? They will live to go into the land. You won't, but they will. I'm going to prove to you that I will do and can do what I said I was going to do. You will die in this wilderness because of your unbelief, but your children, they will possess the land. Now, the only exceptions, of course, to this of those who were 20 years old and up were Joshua and Caleb, because Caleb, of course, was of a different spirit. Joshua believed what God had said as well. Now, of your children, it says in verse 33, they will be wanderers. Literally, it says they will graze. The negative connotation of this is that they will be wanderers, because the first wanderer that we read of in Scripture is Cain. And, of course, Cain was a rebel. So the consequence of rebellion is sometimes wandering. But the positive connotation is borne out through the term to graze. That's literally what it means. And so then looking at Israel as being sheep wandering through the wilderness, grazing, is also to imply that sheep have a shepherd. And even though the shepherd is allowing them to wander, he is still watching over them. Now the spies, of course, had gone into the land and spied it out for 40 days. And so for 40 days, they had been generating a evil response to the people. So God says, okay, for every day that you went through the land, you're going to wander through another land for a year. So 40 days equates to 40 years. And so the punishment, even though it's very severe, is spread out over a number of years. However, the punishment for the spies in verse 36 and 37 was immediate. They died of a plague instantly, but the people who believed their report, they would wander for 40 years. So the sin of the spies then was more than just thinking that we can't take the land. The sin of the spies was that they convinced others that they could not take the land. In other words, they infected the entire nation. It would have been one thing had they felt this way, come to Moses, said, here's my problem, here is my fear, here's the situation. That would have been one thing. But the fact that they went to the people and infected the people with this evil report is really what the magnitude of their sin really is. And so what we should glean from this, I believe, at least one thing, you know, maybe we do have some doubts and fears sometimes. And it's one thing for us to have those doubts and fears and go to God for reassurance or clarity or what have you. But when we allow those doubts and fears to take hold, and then we begin to spread those doubts and fears, and we begin to spread an evil report among the body, this is when we get into trouble. Now, verse 40, after all this has happened, it says that the next morning, the people wanted to go into the land. They said, "We have sinned." But they only come to that realization after the punishment for their sins already been handed down. So verse 41 and 2, Moses tells them, no, now would not be the time to go into the land. Because in fact, if you do, you would be transgressing against the Lord because he's not with you. And if he's not with you and you decide to do this, you're going to die by the sword. Nevertheless, they still haven't learned their lesson. And so they determined to go on, and they go without Moses, and they go without the ark. And guess what? They're defeated at Hormah, which means utter destruction. In other words, at the very place that scholars say they had won a victory over King Arad, which had prompted them to want to send spies into the land. So their victory is what set the stage for the spies to go into the land. But after the spies give the evil report, and they believe it, that's the very place they were defeated. As if to say, here's what happens when I'm not with you, as opposed to what happens when I am with you. And so the march north was most definitely blocked. Now, the next chapter, and specifically in verse 2, it almost seems as if it's going off in a totally different direction that stands in stark contrast to what happened. But maybe that stark contrast is to say, even though this great defeat happened at Hormah, you're not going into the land right now, nevertheless, I'm still going to keep my promise. Because in verse 2 it says, when you are come into the land. And so if this was spoken to them right after these events that are described in chapter 14, of course, this would have been a welcome message. In other words, a reassurance that even though there's judgments, even though there's a consequence of your sin, nevertheless, I'm still going to fulfill my promise that you're going to come into the land. It's just going to be your children. So they were being promised that indeed their children would come into the land. Now we'll skip all the way down to verse 20. And just bring up something more or less as a footnote or an FYI. And that is in verse 20, it talks about when you bring the first of your dough. In other words, when you there was a part of the dough that you were to bring off or take off the first of it or the part of it or a portion of it and give it to the priest. And the word dough there is the word challah. And a lot of you are familiar with the term challah because challah, of course, is the bread that we put on the table at Shabbat. And this is interesting, and this is why I wanted to bring it out, because that the idea of challah comes from this dough that you were to present to the priest. It was something that was set apart and considered holy. And so today, when we put the bread on the Sabbath table, the challah, it is to remind us that this dough was considered something that was set apart for the priests or a gift unto God. And so it's just another little way that we remember these aspects of the Mishkan. Now, like I said, I just brought that out more or less as a footnote. Thought you would find that interesting. Now, in this Torah portion, in light of everything that's happened, it also acknowledges there's another possibility of something that you can do nationally that could result in another national disaster, and that would be mass idol worship. And in fact, it talks about this in the context of it's done in error as opposed to being done willfully. Because if this were to happen in error as opposed to willful defiance, it says that if it's happened, or if I can use this word, accidentally or not intentionally, then the whole community was to bring a common sacrifice. And in verse 26, if this was done with ignorance, and the whole community brings a common sacrifice, then all the congregation, or the entire nation, would be forgiven. Here's why I bring this out and why I find it interesting. Because in Luke chapter 23, verse 34, here's what Yeshua says as he's hanging on the tree. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. In other words, he seems to make it very clear that what they were doing to him and what they were doing as a nation, they were doing it ignorantly. They truly did not understand the magnitude of what they were doing. And so when you have a situation where the nation goes into some kind of egregious error as this, and it's done in ignorance, then they were to bring a common sacrifice. And in this particular case, I want to suggest to you that Yeshua is the national sacrifice, because in John 11, we are told that when Caiaphas said that it's expedient that one man should die and not the whole nation, that he said this not of his own authority, but because he was high priest, he prophesied that Yeshua would die for the nation. And not for that nation only, but that he would also gather together the people of God who were scattered abroad. But the point is, he's the national sacrifice. But he's also the object of their national error. At any rate, he prays that you would forgive them, Father, because they don't know what they're doing. They're ignorant. And if he prayed as the national sacrifice, if I can put it that way, forgive them, did the Father hear his prayer? And if he heard his prayer, did he forgive them? And so if you commit a national error and it's done ignorantly, which this was, according to the words of Yeshua, if the national sacrifice or common sacrifice is brought, then God says, I'll forgive them. It's not to say there won't be consequences, but nevertheless, I'll forgive them. When they committed the national error of giving in and believing the report of the spies, there was a consequence, but there was also forgiveness, because he did bring them into the land. Anyway, I just thought that was something that would, well, that's what the thoughts that it prompted when I read it. Now, in verse 30, this, what we just described to you, things that were done in error or things that were done ignorantly, is then juxtaposed against those things that are done with a high hand, it says, or that is, intentionally, or intentional idol worship. So, publicly defying God's law and doing something with a high hand or intentionally is equivalent to blasphemy. And there is no sacrificial atonement that is possible in this particular case in the Torah, which brings us back then to Yeshua. Because I understand that Yeshua has accomplished for us atonement, or made available for us atonement for those things that we did unintentionally, in ignorance, and for those things that we've done intentionally. But let me ask this question. When somebody does something that's intentionally wrong, is it possible, and I'm not being dogmatic about this, I'm asking the question, that even then, we can't really comprehend the magnitude of what we're doing? Father, forgive them. They really don't know what they're doing. So, Yeshua then, and this is the main point, has accomplished for us the atonement that is available for those things that were done in ignorance and for those things that were done willfully. And so consequently, we don't have to be cut off eternally like those in the Torah portion were to be cut off from the people. Now, Maimonides, who's known as the Rambam, he gleans from this particular command about willful sin that this command has ramifications for other commands. And what he says or writes is that anyone that claims that a particular command doesn't apply to him, or that he has the right to pick and choose which commands to obey, that is equivalent to idol worship. And idol worship is blasphemous. And so consequently, the one who picks and chooses what he wants to obey and not obey, and the one who says that I don't have to obey that one, it's not for me, it's that person is worthy of the same consequence of an idol worshiper. He's worthy of the same consequence of those who blaspheme, because basically what he has said willfully is that God's command concerning this or that or the other really doesn't apply to me, or I don't believe it applies to me, and I'm not going to do that one because I don't like that one. But in this command concerning what we're mentioning here, the scripture makes it very clear that the command is for the homeborn and the stranger. So the stranger doesn't get to pick and choose. And if the stranger or the homeborn picks and chooses, according to Rambam's theory, then that person is guilty of blasphemy, just as much as someone who willfully worships an idol. Now, in verse 32, we have a specific instance of someone who sins intentionally. And that is this man who was gathering sticks on the Sabbath. And so he's profaning the Sabbath. Now, the argument is that to profane the Sabbath, to desecrate that, that is equivalent to idol worship. And idol worship is equivalent to people just deciding what they want to obey and what they don't want to obey. So breaking the Sabbath, again, being equivalent to the idol worship, is viewed this way because one that worships idols is denying the sovereignty of God in deference to another god. But the one who denies his sovereignty by ignoring the Sabbath is doing the same thing, because the Sabbath is testimony and witness that he himself is the creator. And so when someone will not obey the Sabbath or decides that's not for them, they're bringing into question that God is the creator. And so that's equivalent to idol worship. So this particular instance of breaking the Sabbath is placed here to make that point, or at least in part to make that point. Now, it's considered intentional in this sense because it is understood in Judaism that no one could be put to death per the Torah if they profaned the Sabbath or if they committed this transgression. They couldn't be put to death, or the sentence of that transgression couldn't be carried out if they had not been warned repeatedly. And so then, those who found this man and brought him to Moses, it's believed, are the ones who have been repeatedly warning him that he shouldn't do this. And so going over their warnings, he went out and did this anyway. And so they end up bringing this man to Moses. He's doing this. We've warned him, but he continues to do it. And so he's sequestered for a little bit. And then the sentence is passed that he is to die by stoning. And the entire congregation is to witness the sentence being carried out. Because in one vein, we see that the Creator wants everybody to witness the consequences of willful sin. In other words, if you're going to pick and choose, and if you're going to decide what commands belong to you and which ones don't, and if you're going to repeatedly go against warnings and override those warnings and do what you want to do anyway, here are the wages of sin: death. So this is what not to do, Israel. Now, I realize that some people find this very hard to swallow, but I want you to consider this. If you had cancer growing in your body, would you just let it go uncontested? Or would you try and everything in your power to get rid of that cancer? Because if you don't cut that cancer out of your body, then it's going to affect the entire body, and that means the body's going to die. So consider that the Creator sentences this person to death, not because he's cruel and mean, but because he's loving and caring. Because he knows if this willful belligerence goes unchecked and uncontested, that just like the evil report of the spies, it will infect the whole congregation, and the whole congregation will ultimately die. Now in verse 38, again, it seems like the Torah portion goes off in a totally different direction, and yet it doesn't. Because the Creator gives us the command concerning the tzitzit, or the fringes. And it says in Numbers 15, verse 38, "Speak to the people of Israel, and tell them to make tassels, or tzitzit, on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and to put a cord of blue, or tchelet, on the tassel of each corner. And it shall be a tassel for you to look at, and remember all the commandments of the Lord to do them, not to follow after your own heart and your own eyes, which you are inclined to whore after. So you shall remember and do all my commandments and be holy to your God. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Be your God. I am the Lord your God. And so first of all, I want you to notice that the tzitzit, or the fringes, were placed upon the corners. That word also means wings. It's also translated hem of the garment. And so, of course, this is what the woman with the issue of blood reached out to touch when she said, if I can but touch the hem or the corner of his garment, that would mean that she would be grabbing hold of the tzitzit of his garment. Now, later on in time, in Judaism, they will employ the talit, which contains the fringes, to walk in accordance with this command, or the arba kanfot, arba four kanfot, corners, four corners. Because the four corners, or the four wings, is where the fringes are, where the tzitzit are. And so the four corners is to remind us that we take refuge in the shadow of his wings, or his corners, if you will. Anyway, notice that the purpose of looking upon the tzitzit, gazing upon the tzitzit, is to remember and to do the commands. And in other words, it's the tzitzit are there not so much to touch, necessarily, as they are to gaze upon, to look upon. In fact, there is a related word to tzitzit that is hetzitz, and that means to peer or to gaze at something very intently. Now, the word tzitzit in Hebrew has a numerical value of 600. And if you take that value and add it to the 8 threads that are used to make the tzitzit, and then the 5 knots that are used to form the tzitzit, 600 plus 8 plus 5 is 613. 613, of course, alludes to the 613 commands, or as a whole, the Torah, the commandments of God. And so the tzitzit is something that is to remind us of God's commands. And so the implication here is the tzitzit are there as something to look at, something to fix our eyes upon, to gaze intently at them. Why? So that we will remember and do the commands that are given to his people Israel. Because the fringes, or the tzitzit, is, in a manner of speaking, Israel's insignia. And so without that insignia, or without those fringes, we as a people may forget who we are. So these fringes are placed there for us to gaze upon for the purpose of not following our heart and not following our eyes to go our own way. Because there's a way that seems right unto man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. Because the heart and the eyes are the body's spies. And our heart and our eyes will give us, the body, an evil report. And so when we gaze at the Nephilim and we look intently upon the fortified cities, we follow our own heart then and give the body an evil report, and it infects and affects the entire body. And so we don't need to be gazing on what the adversary is doing. We need to be gazing and consequently hearing what the Creator is saying to his people. Because the spies' report convinced Israel that they belonged in Egypt rather than the land of Israel. And so consequently, by believing the evil report of the spies, they forgot their identity. They forgot who they were. And they began to act and to think as Egyptians. Now, as believers, this is important because in James chapter 1, verse 23, he says this, "For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man who looks intently at his natural face in a mirror. For he looks at himself and goes away and at once forgets what he was like." He forgets who he was if he's just hearing the word and not doing the word. So it's one thing to hear what God said, possess the land. It's another thing to to go and do it in spite of the obstacles that you may perceive in front of you. But if you hear him and realize who you are in him, then you will do what he said regardless of what might be in front of you. But if you just hear and do not possess the heart to do, then you'll forget who you are. And in this case, you'll think it would have been better for me to have stayed in Egypt. So, the tzitzit serves as a reminder of who we are and how we should live. Now, notice that it's actually the blue cord, the tehillet, that one is to look upon, and not necessarily the others, because the blue cord of the tehillet is, for lack of a better word, the consummation of those other threads. And if they are to remind us of the commandments, then the blue cord is the consummation of those commandments. And so it's the blue cord that you're actually to look intently upon, because now this blue cord comes from a dye, so says tradition, that came from a mollusk called a chilazon. Now, rabbinically, it is written that we're uncertain of the actual shade or actual hue of this particular blue, or tchelet. Or let's put it this way. They're unsure as to the identity of this blue. And so consequently, they don't use a blue cord. All they have is white cords on their talit or on their talit katan. They don't employ the blue cord. It's missing because they're not sure of its identity. And if it's the blue cord that you're to actually gaze upon and they don't have the blue cord, then this prompts some questions. Now, they do surmise and write and believe that the blue of the tehillet resembles the heavens, and the heavens is the abode of the Creator, and thus, ultimately, the blue cord is to remind of the Creator. And yet, the blue cord is removed. Now, the Hebrew word that's translated it in this particular verse is oto, aleph tav vav. And oto is oftentimes translated as him, H-I-M. And so really, and this is found in rabbinical sources, by the way, this is not just Bill saying this. Really what it says is that you shall look upon him, the blue cord, which is the consummation of the other cords, and the other cords represent the commandments, and so you're looking upon the consummation of the commandments, or shall we say the personification of the word, and you look upon him, and you remember, and you do. But if the him, H-I-M, the blue cord, has been removed, then can you truly remember and do? And if the blue cord, the H-I-M, is the consummation or the personification of the commands, then ultimately who are we talking about? The him is Yeshua. And if he is the H-I-M of the command concerning the tzitzit, and the H-I-M, the blue cord, is missing from their tzitzit, they cannot peer and gaze intently upon him. And if they cannot gaze intently upon him, can they perceive him in the remembering of the commands and the doing of the commands? In other words, can they see Yeshua in the Torah? Now, in Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10, it says, "And I will pour on the house of David and on the people of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of prayers. And they shall look on me, whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one mourns for his only son, and shall be bitter over him as the bitterness of the firstborn." The word look here means to gaze intently in order to perceive something. And notice that when they look upon him, when they look intently upon him, and they perceive him, then they will mourn as one mourns for his only son, as the bitterness over the firstborn. In other words, what we're getting at is Yeshua is that blue cord. And when we look upon him and gaze intently upon him, we are to remember the commandments and we are to do them because he's the personification of those commands. And if you're missing the him in the H-E-M, the him, then you can do and you can remember, but are you perceiving him in these things? So it's striking that this Torah portion begins and ends with the idea of seeing and perceiving. On one hand, at the beginning, it demonstrates what happens when you see and perceive by your own eyes and your own heart, and you follow your eyes and you follow your heart. And then it ends by perceiving and seeing what he says. And when we gaze upon what he says, then we bring our eyes and our heart into submission to his will. And so, again, spiritually speaking, it's more important to hear than it is to see. But when we look at what he says and we hear what he says, we bring our will in submission to his will. But when we let our hearts and eyes go astray, we gaze upon the things that we wish to gaze upon, and we hear what we want to hear, and we follow our hearts, then we find ourselves giving in to an evil report and find ourselves wandering. So with that, folks, we come to the end of our Torah portion commentary. Thanks for joining us. Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BuiltCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BuiltCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.